Welcome, everybody, wherever you're listening to An Hour of Conversation. This podcast is sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Such a great product. I've had mine a few years now. I just can't imagine not having one. I seriously recommend them. And I want to thank Cooker for supporting this podcast. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Today's podcast is a celebrity special. 15 questions to Alex Horn. Yes, I'm trying out 15 questions again, as it seems to work. 19 questions does not work, as I've said before. And I'll say it again, I keep these podcasts around the hour mark. I think that's the way to do it. So 19 questions, too many. 15 seems to just work. I'm a big fan of Alex Horn. He's a great man. He has his band, The Horn Section, who always amuse me. Recently, they went prime time when they were the house band on Peter Crouch Saves Summer. Is it called that? Peter Crouch Saves Our Summer. I'm not sure. Anyway, Peter Crouch's show. It was good. I enjoyed it. I especially love his invention Taskmaster, though, which is one of my all-time favorite shows. How did Alex Horn come up with the idea? Well, let's find out. Here's 15 questions to Alex Horn. Alex Horn, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Tim. Very nice to speak to you.
So I just said in the intro, Taskmaster is one of my favourite TV shows. And during this lockdown period, I have watched them all from series one again. And just because I love it, it makes me laugh. And it's such an easy TV to watch. But what's really funny about it is the show really evolved, didn't it, from series one through to what it is now?
Yeah, I hope so. Because I caught an early episode recently because E4 have put it all on. And yeah, episode one's pretty stark. There's, the format hasn't changed at all, weirdly, but we've just sort of hopefully got better at it, as you'd hope you would do.
Well, one of the differences is you used to be kind of a stickler a bit for the rules, and then people started doing lateral thinking, and now you encourage lateral thinking more than sticking to the rules, don't you?
You probably know it better than me, having watched it all again. I think you're right. We had to keep putting in more lines in the task as well because people got better at lateral thinking. Then they were looking for more gaps, I suppose. So we've had to keep saying, you can't move this, you can't move that. But equally, we quite often have people on who've never seen the show before. And it really surprises me. You think that you'd do some research. But we've had, plenty of people who just come on and go, I haven't got a clue what to do, which is, we need that. I think if everyone came on, like James Acaster knew it inside out.
Yeah.
And, which is great if one of the five is like that. But people, we've had 50 comics on it now, and it's always surprised me that we haven't had two that are the same. You know, everyone's got a different brain.
Recently, I interviewed Richard Herring, and he said he was just the best thing ever because he always wanted to do it. I interviewed James Acaster recently on this podcast, and he also was saying, it was just so good when I got to do the show because I loved it. When I turned, he said, when I turned up and saw the house, he couldn't believe he was at the house. It's like, it's amazing. But I think the casting is one of the beauties of it. There's only a couple of people that I haven't really warmed to. I just love the casting. It's really nice when you get your five contestants there.
Yeah, it's quite nerve-wracking when we start a new series because by the end of the last one, you've got to know them and you've got your favourites. And so you start with these new five people and they feel like imposters in this world. They don't feel like Taskmaster people. But hopefully by the end of episode one, you're back in. But I get nervous every single series thinking this is going to be the one people go, no, we've had enough now.
How did the idea come up? It's your idea, isn't it? You did it in Edinburgh, first of all, didn't you?
Yeah, it wasn't a TV idea, which I always say is probably why it's worked because I'm not a TV producer, but I sort of become one. Through it. So it was just a stupid idea. I was stuck at home. We just had a first kid. And so I sent an email out to 20 comics and said, look, I've got this idea. Next Edinburgh, I'm going to do this show where I'm going to set you a challenge every month. You're going to do them. And I'll tell everyone how it's gone at the end of the year. And that was it. You know, it was just meant to be a laugh. And but they were so competitive straight away. Like one of them would send me something large through the post at Christmas time. And I got so much. I got four Eddie Large autobiographies. I got a subscription to Big and Bouncy, which is still arriving at the moment. Like it was a lifelong subscription to this porn mag, which now my kid's 11.
Oops.
Yeah. But anyway, I don't know what to do. I've got this stack of Big and Bouncy magazines in polystyrene wrappers.
Yeah, of course you have, Alex.
Yeah, I can't. I think if I throw them away, it's going to look awful in the bin if I throw away.
You have to leave them in the park, like when we were kids. that's how they get passed on.
I might go out late at night and distribute them by a train line.
The kids don't have to do that anymore, do they? They now get they've got mobile phones and podcasts, the iPads and stuff.
Yeah, I don't want to think about that. Mine are just before puberty, so I'm just gritting my teeth.
Hasn't Taskmaster been sold to a ridiculous number of countries now, though?
Well, I mean, it has. Yeah, I mean, what's really exciting is that there's a few other countries that make it themselves, like Sweden and Belgium and New Zealand. Now they make their own versions, and that's what I find really nice. You know, seeing me and Greg, but in speaking different languages, and they stick to it really rigidly, which is great. And I mean, there's always press releases where it said it's been sold to 100 countries, but that's because they sell it to BBC Africa, and that's 60 countries, you know. It's kind of it's not quite as worldwide as you might be led to believe, but it is all over the place, which is remarkable, you know. It's a nice feeling when you get an email from someone in Iceland saying they've watched it.
Is it? I mean, look, we all want to write a TV format. Is it as lucrative as people say? I don't want to delve into your finances here, but
let's do it. Let's get the bank statement. Without it, I don't know what I'd be doing, especially at the moment with no live comedy. So yeah, I think you get paid a stupid amount of money for having fun.
Brilliant. All right, let's get stuck into these questions. I'm sure we'll talk more about Taskmaster as we go on. But first question, 15 questions here. We tried 19, Alex, for a while, and it didn't work. It was too long. So I've shortened it to 15, and we'll give that a go. What one piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Well, I haven't really got a motto, but if I had, it would be, it doesn't matter. Three-word phrase I have through my head most of the time. Nothing really matters. Most of the things you have to deal with every day doesn't matter. I go through the day thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner and just try to enjoy the little things.
Yeah, I once had a business with someone who said to me, he didn't work. Shall I say it? No, I'm not going to say who it is. You can Google me and find out if you want, but he didn't really work January and he didn't really work August. And it was frustrating because I had this business with him. And then one day I sort of said to him, like, it's really hard to get hold of you. And he goes, nah, nothing's that important that it can't wait a month.
A month? Oh, that's great. I sometimes don't take my phone from me when I go for a walk for an hour. But a month is great.
A month. He was rich, though. And it's a lot easier to have comments like that when you're rich. Yeah, not really mattering. I like that. I really do like that because I think we get caught up in so much stuff, don't we, that we think matters and it really doesn't.
Well, I think I started feeling that way, especially about live comedy, which is really nerve-wracking. But as soon as I had kids, it felt like nothing mattered anymore except for them. You know, going on telly doesn't matter. It's all gone in an instant. So
yeah, actually that reminds me, when I worked at Planet 24, I remember we were doing Big Breakfast and someone said to me, Tim, it's only television. It doesn't matter. And it changed the way I thought, because you do get caught up. I know a lot of comedians do with this. They get caught up thinking it's really important. Their art. And I was finding that with TV. I was thinking, this is really important. And yeah, it's TV. It's disposable, isn't it? And I suppose comedy to a certain extent is as well.
Yeah, it's very freeing, I think. As soon as you think that, then you can relax on telly. You know, even, you know, being on your program, the first time I was on it, I was very nervous. And then something hit me halfway through. It really doesn't matter because I took it very seriously, Tim, but it's much more fun if you're just there. Actually, more relevant was I did Would I Lie to You recently, and I was very nervous. First time I've been nervous for a long time because I really loved the program. And I was sat next to Lee Mack, and he said, it doesn't matter. I think he used the phrase which I was trying to have in my head, and that really made me relax
Yeah, the two favourite shows, actually, Would I Lie to You and Taskmaster, the two shows that I always watch when I just want to relax and not think about anything and just get on with it. Right, next question. What's the best moment of your career?
Well, I would say it was doing a show at the Palladium with my band, The Horn Section, which we wouldn't have been able to do without Taskmaster. So it's, you know, it's thanks to that. But this band, I've got all my friends from two of my best friends from primary school, and three friends I've known for 20 years, and all our mums were in the audience, and one of them just had their first kid. One of my friends from primary school just had his first kid. And that was a real, you know, sort of dream come true moment. Ken Dodd was my hero growing up, and he just died. And there were lots of pictures of him all around the place. It just felt like one of those moments that it probably won't happen again, and that we're very lucky to do it. The show went on far too long, and people started drifting away by the end, but that doesn't matter.
Well, that's like Ken Dodd, isn't it? Didn't Ken Dodd used to do like 4 or 5 hour shows?
Yeah, I've seen him a few times. I saw him with my friend, with Tim Key. We used to go and watch him when we were in our 20s. And one time we watched the first hour and a half, then went to watch a football match in the pub and had a curry, and then came back and watched the last hour. And, completely true in Nottingham.
What did he do for all that time?
He mainly talked about how long the show was. Every other joke was about the fact that the show was long. So without, like, if you cut away those jokes, it'd just be a tight hour. But he did songs, he did ventriloquism, there was dancing. I loved him. He was great.
Why did he do so long?
It was definitely his life. You know, all his life was on stage.
Yeah.
So I think he didn't want to get off stage, especially when he was, you know, in his 80s at the end.
I feel a bit like that when I do the Sunday Brunch. It's 3 hours long and it's a long show, as everyone always comments on. I love it so much. And when I come off air, I'm like, oh God, I wish I could go for another 3 hours. I'm exhausted when I finish the show, but I just love it. It's really, I love those 3 hours.
That's a very good sign, isn't it? That's got to be good. I mean, I'm the same with us. We did 2 studios in a day, so it's long. It's about, 4 hours in the studio, but it's the best bit of my year, you know.
What was it like when you got, it was the UN, the horn section, wasn't it? Which is Peter Crouch's, I couldn't get the name of it, Saving Summer, Our Summer.
It was called Peter Crouch, Save Our Summer, which is, you know, it was all put together quite hastily, but it was really fun. It was for us a nice silver lining of lockdown, because it felt quite a bit like maybe Big Breakfast. It was quite put together on the day. We didn't have any rehearsals because we couldn't, because of lockdown. It wasn't live and there wasn't an audience, but it felt like we were being quite brave and just trying to do telly in a difficult situation.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was good because I like Peter Crouch, and you know, his presenting skills weren't the best, but it doesn't matter because he's a lovely guy. And Maya Jama was there to do that, and you were there to add the comedy and the showbiz with the band. I just thought it worked really well. I loved it. Great show.
Oh, good. I'm really glad. It was a very odd thing because it was BBC One, and you do feel like you're putting your head above the parapet. And the first episode, people were not kind to us on Twitter, but luckily, because of my motto, I really didn't care. And by the end, they just sort of got on board. I think you're right. Peter's so amiable, and he got better and better as well. He sort of, by the end, looked like a TV presenter, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the people criticize anything that's new. You just got to ignore that. That's definitely the way. Right. Yeah. What's the worst moment of your career?
It was early on. I'd done an Edinburgh show with Tim Key. We spend a lot of time together, and we were booked in Bangor in Northern Ireland to do our hour-long show, which was all about science. And we turned up and there's a big sign outside saying adult comedy night. And it was just me and Tim, and they'd put a Billy Connolly video on, and it was all men in the audience, and they were loving Billy Connolly. Then the bloke came on, pressed pause, and we came on with our overhead projector, and we lasted 4 minutes, and then somebody shouted, "Can we put Billy back on?" So we did, and we shuffled out, and it was horrible. We hid in a B&B, and it was just really soul destroying. And all my in-laws are from Northern Ireland, and I just felt ashamed and embarrassed. But it's a good story.
Did you ever think about giving up, or have you always just thought, no, this is it, this is the career for me?
No, I think I've always felt that it was a career for me without feeling very confident. But it's more I thought about giving up aspects of it. So I used to do the Jongleurs clubs a bit, which was sort of the stag nights.
Yeah.
And I found it, but I was very happy to give that up eventually. You know, there's bits that I can do and bits that I can't. I think it's just knowing yourself slightly.
What does success mean to you?
I suppose it's being able to say no to things. In terms of work, it's being able to do choose the things you want to do a bit more rather than just accept everything to pay the mortgage. So I'd say the last couple of years I've really enjoyed success because I've only done things I wanted to do. And a couple more doors open. So we've been able to do things with the horn section.
One of the things which really showed how successful you've become, well, your product Taskmaster, was during the initial lockdown, how you were setting tasks on social media. It just went mental, didn't it, for you?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, we were asked to set a couple of tasks by some mums when the schools shut to keep them occupied. I'm sure we talked about it probably during a Zoom episode of your program.
Yeah, I was at home and I had to do a Zoom call with you, which was, it was never as good as live TV, but it was fun to do nonetheless.
Yeah, well, we set this task on YouTube and I think we had 500,000 people sort of watching it, and thousands doing it all over the world, and people sending in stuff from Mexico and China. And yeah, that was a good moment when you think, oh yeah, we've hit a nerve somewhere. And also when you occasionally feel like you're doing something positive in our line of work is nice.
I do a mini Taskmaster with my daughter because we got a lot of time to fill at nighttime. And I do tasks with her a lot, inspired by your show. She comes in, I set a 10 tasks, like set up a chessboard as quickly as you can, or
brilliant.
You know, draw a picture of a car, and she has to go around, do 3 cartwheels. And we just do this, but it's based on trying to get her just to think about things as well. And, you know, and I love it. And it's all based on spending time watching your show, basically. So
yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, I've been to a few primary schools and done Taskmaster days, and kids are brilliant at it because they do come at things from a different angle. And they also don't know their limitations. They think they can do anything. So yeah, anything involving families. This isn't me plugging something. It sort of is. But we've put out, I think today or tomorrow, a Taskmaster package that you can get on the website. It's £10, but it all goes to homeless charities. But it's something families can do over Zoom. So yeah, if you've got kids, it's really good. It's £10, but that's it. And all the money goes to charity.
Is it taskmaster.co.uk or .com?
It's taskmaster.tv.
.tv, okay.
You do have to then go to our merch shop, which is sort of slightly, you know, slightly cynical, making people go to there. But I promise you, all the money goes to the right people.
Do you sell a lot of merch?
I mean, I'm not, that's not me. That's not my world. But I think I sometimes get sent pictures of people drinking out of a Taskmaster mug. And there's nice. An 8 thing, I think. Yeah.
Nice. What other jobs did you do?
I worked in a potato factory. I had to stand beside a conveyor belt and pick up moldy potatoes or toads. Because when you farm for potatoes, Tim, they basically pick up the whole field, sieve out anything smaller than a potato, and the rest go on a conveyor belt. And but that includes moldy potatoes and toads. So my job was to only touch those things for a summer.
And what did they do with the toads?
I thought about this recently. I haven't got a clue. I had to put the toads down one chute and the potatoes, the mouldy potatoes, down another. I don't know. I never thought to question it. I just popped them in and off they went.
And was there any mindfulness in that job? Did you enjoy it
at
all?
Yeah, it was really mindful. I think a lot of people talk about this, don't they? When they had, I saw Vernon Kay talking about it on I'm a Celebrity this week. That those jobs, because it's all around friendships, and I think I was 19, the work doesn't matter at all. You get some cash, you all go to the pub at the end of it. It was, you know, maybe one of my favourite ever summers.
Yeah, I think it's important about work. I mean, when I did Soccer AM for all those years, those 11 years, everyone talks about what's the success of the show. It was, you know, it was successful for a satellite TV show on a sports channel. And it just because we all for some reason all got on. We used to hang out together. We had a laugh. It must be like you in the horn section, you know? It's
yeah, you it enjoying rubs yourself. Off on you, doesn't it? I think it rubs off on the audience. I mean, definitely with Soccer AM, we all watched it because we felt like we were part of your gang. And the same with Big Breakfast as well. I wouldn't miss an episode of Big Breakfast for a year because you didn't want to miss a second of the fun you were having. And I think it's with the horn section, I'm always trying to make them laugh and they're trying to make me laugh. So it looks, you know, we are mates. And I think that's crucial to it because we're not particularly skillful. So
is the horn section, are you like, is that everybody's job or do the other people all have other jobs as well?
It's quite a considerable amount of some of their career. So they all teach music as well. Some of them play in other bands, like one of them plays with Robbie Williams, one of them plays with Madness. So they're all session musicians, I suppose. But it's sort of half of our lives, I suppose. It's a weird one.
What do you do when you go out and do gigs? I mean, I've seen you on TV. I've never seen one of your gigs. Is it all comedy songs?
Yeah, that sounds awful, I think. Like.
It does, doesn't it? I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's more mucking about. So there's lots of, and this sounds even worse, improv stuff with the audience. We have half of the set we know what we're going to do, and half of the set we muck about and get, you know, suggestions from the audience, and we try to play songs that we don't know. Yeah, it's better than it sounds.
And yeah, but you've got a podcast together, all of you as well, haven't you?
Yeah, we've done that for a few years now, and we're still doing it in lockdown. Zoom is not good for music because you can't all play your instruments because the timing's slightly out. But we found a way of doing it, and actually not being in the same room, it's quite nice because yeah. we get more stuff done when we're not, you know, annoying each other all the time.
I tell you what I love, and I've said this to you every time I see you, actually, but because it just really, it's one of those things that really stuck when you decided to do a cover version of the Spice Girls' Wannabe.
Right.
And you just went, I tell you what I want, what I really, really want. I tell you what I want, what I really, really want. And you just did that over and over and over again. That was the only bit of the song you did, which was fantastic.
I think that's a very good example of our humour. It's pretty basic stuff, but we stick with an idea. We've done that for maybe 5 minutes sometimes on stage, just those lines, and people stop laughing and then get angry and then start laughing again.
It's great. Okay, what is your outstanding fashion moment? This could be good or bad.
Well, I still, on stage, this is the thing you get at the Horn Section show, I wear Heelys. You know those shoes with
yeah.
And I think I look so cool. So I've occasionally worn them in Chesham, where I live, because I live at the top of a hill, and I can just whiz all the way down. And I think I look great. So that's definitely my thing. You get them in grown-up sizes. They're a bit tight. But
How hard are they to learn to do, though? They basically just got a wheel in the heel. Is that right?
They're about a week of training, Tim. Because it's quite counterintuitive. They're the opposite of roller skates. You have to lean back rather than forward.
Right.
Yeah, you feel like a fool for a week doing it on your driveway.
Why did you first buy them?
I think it was a sort of why not. You know, I saw a kid do it and thought, well, she looks brilliant. So I had a look on the internet and bought them. Yeah, that was it, really. There was no big plan.
All right, next question. What do you do to keep fit?
Well, I was embarrassed about this for quite some time, but I now admit it. I've had a personal trainer for 5 years who I see once a week. She's called Kat Merchant, and she used to play rugby for England. And she just treats me like, actually, she's great. But she doesn't shout at me, but she's strict with me, which I'm not strict with myself. And I love it. So once a week for an hour, we go to the local park and she makes me run around or chase balls. It's different every week. And
Do you mind getting naked on Taskmaster?
No, I don't. I'm aware I've got a very average body, but I'm not ashamed of it. It's not awful, but it's not good. But there's probably, you know, we're all vain to some extent, I'm sure. Well, I am anyway. So part of me seeing this lady is just because I know people do keep making me take my trousers off and my clothes off. And without it, I would look very fat.
And you got...
I like eating and drinking, and I don't want to ever stop those things.
Is it three boys you've got?
Yes, yes. Eight, 9 and 11.
Who are all into football.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go out and kick around with them? Are you any good? Are you handy? Can you play?
I used to think I was really good. I'm in goal a lot in the garden, and they started being able to hit it hard. And that's awful when you're sort of flinching, trying to look tough for your kids. And I can hit it as hard as I want now at the older one. He's a goalkeeper. And that's really fun, just smacking it at him. So, yeah, I do get out. They keep me, you know, keep me young. And, I wish I could. But that's the thing I miss from school most, I think, is competitive football. I used to love it so much.
Though, the bit I loved most about football was the contact. I like tackling. I played central midfield a lot or towards the back. I wasn't fast and I wasn't didn't play up front. But I love the tackling. I love going on the pitch and I love coming off with bruises. And it seems to have gone out of the game a lot now. And I volunteered to hang out with some kids not so long ago. And I was playing some football with them. And every time any of them got touched, they stood up and went, "Oh man, what are you doing? It's contact, you know, no contact sort of thing." And I was thinking, no, it isn't, but it is now. It's like, you know, there was something joyous about tackling years ago.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I referee the under 12s sometimes, and they are, anytime they get nudged at all, they think it's a foul. So we're trying to keep not blowing the whistle. and trying to say that's not a, you know, a foul is a foul, but some contact isn't. So, yeah, I agree. I kind of want my kids to be tough, you know, and not dive. And
well, I think it's, I think the sport changed at some stage where when we played, it was like, you've got, it's a man's sport. You've got to go on and you've got to take all the punishment you can get. And if someone hits you, you get up. And then somewhere in the 90s towards the noughties, it became acceptable to be rolling around on the floor. And then you had, you know, your pundits, your Michael Owens and everybody going, he has the right to go down. He was touched. And you're going, no, he doesn't. Because yeah, he's supposed to stand his feet. And then I remember watching women's football and thinking, Jesus Christ, this lot stay on their feet and try and ride every tackle. And I found myself in the last Women's World Cup going, this is much better football.
Because yeah,
like, it just, they wanted to stay on their feet because their attitude still is, I want to stay on my feet and play the ball, you know? So,
yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I always think penalties are worth, they shouldn't be worth a whole goal. Because I think, you know, these handballs nowadays, obviously everyone's talking about them, that doesn't feel like it should be a goal. But also, if it wasn't the incentive of these game-changing moments, they wouldn't go down so much. I mean, I don't know what the stats are, but there must be more now.
I mean, this isn't a football podcast, but whilst we're on this subject, when people try and compare Messi and Ronaldo to Maradona, Pelé, Zidane, whoever, Cruyff, it's not the same. Because if you watch, there was Maradona's 60th the other day, and so everyone was posting footage of him. The tackles which went in on Maradona, and he had to ride them, because if he didn't, he would never score goals, because they were not yellow cards even, the tackles back then. So there was this beauty, and if you watch original, there's a great video of original Ronaldo, and he was when it started changing, and all the beginning of his career, he's riding tackles and scoring goals, and towards the end he was going down, you know, because that was how the game was changing. I think it's a shame, but there were a lot of career-ending tackles, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I'm a Liverpool fan, and we've lost Virgil for the season, and I'd prefer that didn't happen.
So, have you ever seen? So again, this isn't a football podcast, but Graham Souness's tackles. Oh my God! Yeah. When Souness sits there and goes, "Yeah," he raised his foot. I was like, "Mate, you've got to see some of your." Souness was such a great player, but some of the tackles. Oh wow!
Yeah. Yeah, I can't think of a hard man now, you know, in the game at the moment. Like, as in a famous hard tackler. I'm sure they are, but...
Yeah, like, you know, there's no such thing as a Ben Thatcher anymore, and you're never going to get a Vieira versus Keane, are you?
Anymore? No. Oh, I loved those contests.
So did I, yeah.
Oh, they were, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
On that football, banging on about Taskmaster again, what I also love about it is when you get to see celebrities that you didn't expect to be good at things. So the prime example of that is Noel Fielding. Suddenly, because he wears the cowboy boots and the heels and all that sort of stuff. Suddenly when he was doing on his series, every trial which involved sport, he was brilliant at it, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he had trials. I think he's one of these, like the guy Serge from Kasabian.
Yeah.
Who's great at football. Yeah, I think Noel had trials for someone. And we filmed at Chesham United with him. And he was so pissed off that there was a task where they had to score a goal with a plastic bag.
Yeah.
And he was so pissed off that he couldn't show off his skills and that we didn't tell him to bring his boots. Because he's properly good. And he said he gets frustrated because people assume he's this arty type who hangs out with Russell Brand all the time. But he's really sporty. And he's also really competitive. But he was desperate to win.
Yeah, I could see it when he was even just doing keepy uppies with his boots. You could see he can play football, you know, and he was good. And the other one that made me laugh was Tim Vine, who's a good darts player. You said the darts challenge. What's great about it is sometimes you can see in his eyes, because I know he can play darts. I've seen enough of his career to know that he loves darts and plays it. But you could see in his eyes that he was so upset that he didn't rise to that challenge. It was great.
If you want to follow anyone on Twitter, I'd follow Tim Vine, because he did a thing last weekend, I think. He just put a camera on his 180 on his dartboard and said, right, tune in. I'm going to play as long as it takes me to get a 180. And it took him 40 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Not bad. He's a proper player. Yeah. I don't think I've ever got a 180.
Do you with Taskmaster, do you look at the guests and think, okay, they've got this sort of skill, maybe we'll do a task towards that sort of skill?
Slightly. I mean, there's 40 odd tasks in the series, so we try to cover everything. But we do make sure, like Johnny Vegas is in the current series, and we want people to know that he's an artist. You know, he's a proper potter and sculptor. Yeah. So we make sure there's enough arty ones in there, but also you don't want people to be good at everything. So it's a balance. You know, we made sure there's sporty things if there's sporty people. I think the darts one we probably did put in for Tim. Yeah. So yes, yes and no.
Okay. All right. Tell our listeners something that has been life-changing for you.
It's quite a boring answer, I suppose, but genuinely it was university, because not because of what I studied, but the people I met there. So I met my wife. I met most of the people I'm still performing with. I mean, I knew the band before, but that's where I met the rest of the band, Tim Key and Mark Watson, and just lots of like-minded people, I suppose. And I spent lots of the time there either playing sport or doing comedy and making friends. So, yeah, I really want my kids, not necessarily to go to university, but to have a couple of years like that where you work out what you want to do with yourself.
Which one did you go to?
Cambridge, which a bit like personal trainers, I've always been slightly reticent, sort of a bit embarrassed about, because it felt like you were privileged. I mean, I was very privileged to go there. And if I was worried that people thought that's, you know, that all every door was open because you went there. But I think there might be some truth in that, but also there's just like-minded people there and a weird amount of good comedians come out of it.
Yeah. So Cambridge is Footlights, right?
Yeah. Which is all that is nowadays is an open mic comedy club. So once a week you go there and it's a tough crowd because they're all clever students who think they know best. And you learn how to do it. So it is a good training ground if a weird one.
Isn't the key to comedy though, you have to be smart, don't you? Because you're looking for ways to take reality and shift it a bit to find the joke. So I always think all the comedians I love, maybe not academically smart, but they're all ridiculously smart people. Their brains are working very quickly.
Yeah, there's definitely a smartness, and that's not reflected in academia necessarily. And often in Taskmaster, the cleverest people like Mark Watson and Paul Sinner have done the worst because they've got no common sense. but also on, you know, House of Games. Do you ever watch House of Games?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah.
The comedians always win that because they've got just that brain. They think in a slightly different way, I think.
Yeah. Paul Sinner was hopeless on your show, wasn't he, Taskmaster?
Completely useless.
Apart from when you got him to, look, I'm like the super fan. Apart from when you got him to memorize a pack of cards, and then he was brilliant. Oh, he got one wrong or something and then beat himself up over that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love Paul. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any daily routines?
I sort of do. It's probably every other day, but I try to. I try to get up half an hour before the kids and have a coffee in bed. I've got a coffee machine in the bedroom. And that starts...
What? Like, yeah. It's like a tease, mate. That's like something my nan and granddad would have had.
Yeah, well, my wife and I live in the loft. We've got a sort of a three... We converted the loft. And so we're away from the kids, basically. They've got a floor and we've got a floor. So I try not to see them for half an hour in the morning. That honestly, that starts the day so much better. I don't know. That's about it, really. And then I have 2 hours of getting them to school. My wife does an early shift on the radio. So I've got the kids in the morning and I don't sit down till 9 o'clock till they've gone.
Do you like this? Do you like doing the school run?
I do. I think it's a good bit of the day.
Yeah.
I'm quite proud.
Having two grown-up kids and one young one, so my eldest are twins, they're 18, and my youngest is 7. The first time around, I literally couldn't stand the getting ready in the morning, and I'd get one of the twins ready, then be trying to get the next twin ready, and the first twin had taken her clothes off and all that sort of stuff. But second time round, the morning routine for me is the best thing ever. The getting up, having breakfast, you know, if we have to bath and wash hair or whatever we have to do in the morning, and then the school run is, honestly, I wish I'd done it with the twins. I cherished it as much, because when it goes, you're like, oh, I love that bit.
Yeah. My eldest is now at secondary school. So he goes in the morning, goes out the front door and comes back by himself.
Yeah.
And I don't know anyone there. I don't know any of the families I'm partly because of lockdown. But yeah, I'm already missing that. So yeah, that's a good advice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Also though, I'm quite bad. I sometimes worry about if I'm a sociopath, because I drop them off and I don't think about them again until I never once think, I wonder what they're up to. As soon as I've dropped them off, that's it.
I saw my kids the other day, and they are, I saw my kid. I went past their school, and they're all playing in the school playground. So I thought, I'm going to go and see if I can see her. So I went up to the fence and started looking through, and a woman arrived from nowhere and went, "Excuse me, you can't stand here. Go away." And I'm like, "Hold on, I'm a dad." And then they're like, "Leave the gates." I was like, "Oh, God, I think I'm a peeper or a pervert or something." Do you have any? Do you have any? Just on the routine thing, are you? Because now you're showbiz. Have you got any food things you're doing, like a vegan or? Or vegetarian, or only food beginning with a C or something. I mean, I don't know.
No, what I do, all I do is my wife gives me a drink every morning, which she's made at the weekend, which has got spinach in and stuff. And I think it works. It's pretty disgusting, but I drink that to make her happy and probably to keep me healthy. And that's it. So no, we try to eat slightly less meat sometimes.
And you haven't been ill all this year. No one, apart from if you've got COVID, no one's got colds this year or flu, have they? Well, I suppose some have, but...
No, I agree. I feel pretty healthy. You know, we've sort of looked after each other a bit more and... Yeah, no, I don't know. I think probably veganism is a good thing, but I haven't got the willpower.
No, nor have I. It's sound like hard work. Right, what's the key to a good relationship? This could be work, friendships, family, partners, anything you like.
For me, it's watching... TV dramas where someone's been unfaithful, and it all unravels, and you think, "Oh God, yeah, that's a good point."
We did this on this podcast right at the beginning. Mark, the guy who used to produce this podcast with me, we were discussing having an affair, and he said, "Oh, sounds like a lot of admin to me," and it really made me laugh. So we actually had early episodes of this podcast right at the beginning. We had a trilogy of people who'd been in affairs: a man who'd had an affair, a woman who had been part of an affair, and a married woman who had been had the affair happen behind her back, sort of thing. And all three, it wasn't the same affair; it was three different cases. But every single one of them, their lives had turned into an absolute disaster. There's no good which comes of doing it. If you want to have an affair, split up with the person you're with first and then do it. Otherwise, the admin's horrific.
Yeah, and probably for a moment of superficial pleasure. I mean, who knows why people do things, but yeah, honestly, but those, there's such a reminder when you see or hear a story like that, and you think, yeah, God, yeah, just got to be
how did you choose Greg as the taskmaster?
He was honestly the only possible choice, really. Like, comedy is quite a small world, so you know most people who are on it, who are the same level as you. And I gigged with him a few times. We weren't mates at all, but he's just such a obvious choice. Tall and powerful, mainly very, very funny, but he's just got a commanding presence and he's happy to take people down. And people like it when they slag him off.
How long was it before you two gelled with your little Alex Horn and everything else?
I'd say a series or two. We never planned it, and we didn't really meet up for the first couple of years socially. Now we're definitely friends. We went camping together when the rules were relaxed. We went camping, which is we're an odd couple, tent and camper van. But a couple of years. It took, I think, watching back, probably that's one thing you'd notice. I don't think it was ever forced, but we know each other's timing a lot better now.
Seriously, not forced. Beautiful to watch the evolution of it. If you go back and watch from series one, I'm watching Greg, not sure how far to push it. And then by series maybe three, he's absolutely hammering everyone constantly and people love it. But he was just not, it was great. And then he was hammering you and it just worked so well. But watching that evolve was, I really did enjoy watching it again from series one. I recommend anyone do it. You should do it, Alex.
Well, I'm not sure if I should. I'm tempted now, but I'd worry that then I'd unpick it too much and, you know, be too deliberate about it because we never talk about it. Yeah. We just sort of do it. So I think it's more natural that way.
All right. Next question. How's your mental health?
I think I'm lucky that it's absolutely fine. I think if I think about it too much, I worry that if I think about it too much, it would unravel. Right. So, I'd say I think about death probably once a year. And I'm all right with it. You know, it's going to happen.
I think thinking about death's a really healthy thing to do. I've had sometimes depression, and a lot of the self-help book type things always sort of tell you to think about death a lot because it encourages you to live life now, you know, and you don't want to be sitting on your deathbed going, "God, I really did think that mattered," when it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's a good point. No, I think I've got some friends who've got depression. So, and in a way that helps. It helps that it's in the public domain now. Whereas when we're in our 20s, I don't think I'd heard anyone who had it, I suppose. But it helps you realize how lucky you are if you are fairly happy.
Yeah, I think society's creating it as well. I think it's something that we're creating more of. I think it's something we're producing, which is not great. I think we need to look at the way we're doing society. Let's move on from that, because I've got a brand new question that I've never asked anyone. Whoa. So this could be exciting, or it could bomb here. Let's find out. Tell us about a scar.
I've got two, but they're both...
I felt very Alan Partridge saying that, by the way. So I'm not sure I'm going to do that again.
You haven't got a good, more catchy name for that question.
I have. Scars of the Stars.
Scars of the Stars. I've got two scars, and they're both pathetic. I've got one on my eyebrow, just my left eyebrow there, which is a rugby incident when I was at school. And I was quite proud of it because I think I was maybe 14, and it split open. My dad had to give me stitches on the side of the pitch. Then I carried on playing. So that, I think I was a hero for a year there.
Yeah.
So was my dad. I've also got an appendix scar in a very intimate position.
Were you one of those ones who got rushed into hospital and they with a bad stomach ache? And they said, did you have that story that literally a day later I'd be dead? One of those.
Yeah. I think I was only 11. It's the only time I've been ill, really, but I'd swallowed a dog hair apparently. And the dog hair had slid down my intestines and punctured the appendix, and it got infected and swelled up. And I had an awful stomach ache. And my dad said, oh, yeah, he's a GP. He said, you've got to go now. And they said, yeah, if you hadn't had it taken out, it would have burst, and who knows what would happen.
Ah. Well, I'm not sure whether that question's coming back or not. I'll have to see. See, I had Jason Fox on the other day, you know, the SAS guy. Actually, SBS. I keep making that mistake. And I think I didn't ask him that question. It could have been a better answer. You know,
yeah, it does depend on the guest, doesn't it, I suppose. I mean, I could have made something up, but I've had a pretty cushy life, really.
Yeah. All right, next question. When was the happiest you've ever felt?
I guess it's my wedding day, Tim. It's okay to be earnest sometimes.
Yeah.
And we were very young. It was 2005, so I was 26. Mm-hmm. And it was New Year's Day, and because that was the only day we could get the church, I think. And it was over in Northern Ireland, so all my friends came over. No one had kids at that point, so everyone made a holiday of it and stayed over for a couple of days. And it's just brilliant. You know, just a great time. And I think we filmed it, or someone filmed it, and I haven't watched it back. And we're sort of waiting for the right time to watch that with the kids. Because, I mean, I was a different person.
Are you happy when you go on stage?
Yeah, I don't get nervous at all anymore. I think when we've got a new song or a new bit, we're excited and are worried about whether we remember it. But I'm never nervous about the audience reaction. It's definitely, that's the time I'm happiest professionally, I suppose. Being on stage, mucking around, whether it's with Greg or the band. I love that.
And what was the pitching process like of Taskmaster? That, I mean, that must have been amazing when you heard that. Dave originally took the show, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a long process. It wasn't an awful lot of fun because you have meetings and people tend to be pretty excited whether they think it's a good idea or not. They very rarely tell you in the room that it's a bad idea. But we got turned down by everyone, including Channel 4. And Dave as well turned it down, and then eventually came back and said we've had a rethink. So it was really exciting when I had a phone call saying they're going to do it, but it was only one series, and you're always thinking that's all we'll get. So yeah, it's a weird one when someone says, right, you're going to make the program now, because you've then got the pressure of delivering something.
Have you written any other formats?
Yeah, quite a few. And there's some things might happen. Some things definitely won't. It's not all doors open now at all. You've got to really work to persuade people that your ideas are good.
I've had most of my ideas turned down, really. And And I've done a few. I had one made, and then obviously Soccer Am I took over, and it was a completely different show, and I changed it. But that doesn't count. But not so long ago, I went and pitched an idea with a friend of mine who's not really in the industry, and he came out of the meeting and he went, "I can't believe it. We're going to do this show." I went, "No, we're not." I said, "Yeah, that happens in every meeting. Every meeting they go, I love it. It's brilliant." And I said, "Next week there'll be a list of things which they don't think are right with it." And it's kind of a little bit of hedging their bets. And then you go away, you come back, and then eventually they say no. That's what
Yeah. And they're being pitched stuff all the time by all sorts of people. And they've probably heard your idea before, but in a different guise. Yeah, it's quite grounding, that, I suppose. But yeah, you learn to cope. Because we did Taskmaster in America. We had to pitch it there to all these big networks. And they're even worse. We came out of every single meeting thinking, wow, we're going to be huge stars in America. And then one by one, you get the nose back saying, actually, not for us.
Were you going to do it as you and Greg?
No, we did. We did one series with me and Reggie Watts over there for Comedy Central.
Oh.
A few years ago. It was fun. It didn't quite work for various... Well, I'm not sure quite. It didn't take off. But it was interesting.
Okay. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Yes.
Yes, at last! Sorry.
I was talking... Do you know, Daisy May Cooper is on the current series.
Oh, Daisy May Cooper is so funny.
Yeah.
I love her. She's brilliant.
Well, she is a big ghost hunter. She really believes in them.
Yeah, her and her brother.
Yeah. And I talked to her recently, and I remember that in 2003, I saw a UFO in London with... I was working at Monkey Kingdom TV. Do you know that? Yeah. I was a runner, and I walked out of the building with someone called Rebecca, who was a producer, and I've not seen her since, and not mentioned this to her. But we both looked up, and there was a UFO, I promise, in the sky, sort of near Angel, Islington. And we both watched it for a bit, and then we got on the tube and didn't mention it again. But it was definitely, it was round, had lights all the way around it. And I think we both thought, well, it can't be. But I've thought about it a lot of times since, and there's nothing else it could have been.
Hold on, but there was what, you, so you think it was aliens on there, do you?
yeah, I suppose so. I mean, it was quite near City Airport, but it was round. It was definitely round, and it was sort of came down like a helicopter would. But it was, you know, it looked like a UFO.
And did you the next day look in the newspapers and go?
No, I didn't think anything about it at all. We thought if we tell people about this, then that's, you know, we'll be laughed out of the world.
See, so, I want to believe in ghosts and alien UFOs, but I've never seen any of them, so I can't. But then when people like you say that, then because I trust that you wouldn't lie to me here.
Yeah. We didn't have cameras. It was before, you know, decent camera phones. I'm tempted to track this lady down and see if she remembers it, because that's what I need, I think, is corroboration.
I do think you need to do that. You do need to do that. Right. Is there something you've changed your mind about?
You know what? Very little. I think in comedy writing, I've tried to write a sitcom before and it didn't go well, but it was all about whether people can change. And I think maybe they can't. I tried to this season give up Liverpool and support Chesham United full time. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't stop supporting them, even though I'm a proper plastic fan. You know, I'm from the South and I watched them twice a season live. But, and the same with veganism, religion. I think pretty much there's very few things I've changed my mind on. I can't think of one. I don't know if that's because I'm stubborn, but...
How are Chesham United doing at the moment?
Pretty good, pretty good. I mean, we had to stop because of lockdown. Mm. But non-league football is thriving because you can go there. We've had gates of 600 this season and you can drink there. And everyone's very health safety conscious. There's a big announcement every few minutes saying stand 2 metres apart. But it's brilliant. It's a sort of place where the town's gathering every week.
Who's playing for Liverpool when you... Was it Dalglish era?
Rush. Yeah, so Rush was my hero. I always wanted to be in Rush. You know, everyone was a character in those days. So, you know, Molby and Grobbelaar. Grobbelaar played for Chesham, by the way, after he retired.
Did he?
Yeah. Hanson, all that lot. You know, you can name 1 to 11. Even people like Ronnie Whelan and Ronnie Rosenthal. I think every single person felt like you knew them inside out.
Liverpool, that Liverpool team were the first team to play a whole team with not one English player.
Mm.
1986, wasn't it? Yeah, there were Scottish and Irish and people like that. And,
yeah, Ray Houghton, people like that.
Yeah.
I guess the end of Alan Kennedy. Yeah, yeah.
I think it was...
But in those days, Mulby was exotic, even though he had a Scouse accent.
They were fantastic, those players. I've met Ian Rush loads of times. I played football with Ian Rush, actually. And
Is he nice?
Oh, he's so nice.
Brilliant.
He's so nice. I'll tell you my Ian Rush story very quickly. It's not a football podcast yet. So there's me, Rush, and Beardsley playing at Wembley, right? And in one of these matches. And I was a decent enough player. And my team was winning, and Rushy goes, come, we've got to get Tim a goal. So it's the pattern of play went something like Lovejoy to Rush, Rush to Lovejoy, Lovejoy to Beardsley. I'm on the box, at the edge of the box. Beardsley's got it on the right-hand side. He's running down. He goes to put the cross in, puts the cross in. I run, and then I can hear Rushy going, Tim, oh, you've gone too soon. The ball goes over my head. Rushy comes in back post and just slots it in. And it's like, that was the time I realised about scoring is all about timing. It's about the right runs and all that. And I just never had it. And Rushy was just, that would have been the best moment ever to score in that passage of play. But
how often do you rerun that in your head?
Oh, it's not as bad as when I played at Anfield and I was in the 6-yard box and I hit the post. Just me and the goalkeeper. I can't remember who's in goal now. And I always said, the defender got a touch on it. And I've watched it so many times in slow motion. But the best thing ever was, the two things I love are the cop booing me when I came out because I'm a Chelsea fan. Mm. I love that. And I love the fact that they all just did the sort of rude hand gestures when I didn't get the goal. And I loved it at the cup final once where Liverpool fans made a banner which says, Lovejoy sucks big fat cocks.
Yeah, you've got to take that as a compliment, I suppose.
I thought that was brilliant. Alex, final question, because I like your 15 questions so much. You get the bonus, the answers, sorry, so much. You get the bonus question. What is the meaning of life?
I think I've sort of alternated serious answers and vaguely lighter answers. But for me, I think it's... I reckon the meaning of life changes for everyone. It depends on you, really. But for me, it's the children, I think. You know, as in my children, not the children of the world.
You're not doing Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
We are the world type thing.
No, I think my life...
That didn't work, saying the Michael Jackson thing at all, did it?
But I think my life only, you know, without sounding too pretentious, but my life has meaning because of my kids then going on and trying to make them into decent people, I suppose. And that's it, really. I think, you know, you can have a very meaningful life without kids. But my particular life is a bit frivolous without them.
Perfect. Great answer. Alex, thank you so much for joining me today. If people want to follow you, where's the best place to do it? Social media?
Twitter. I don't do Instagram and I'm not very good at Twitter. It's all self-promotion, but that's partly because people want to, you know, find out about things.
Yeah. Okay. So what's that? What are the address? Just Alex Horn?
Just at Alex Horn. Yeah, that's the place.
Alex, so much. Thank you so much for joining me today. And I'll see you very soon, hopefully.
Cheers, Tim. See you soon.
Dear Lovejoy is written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Blake Fellows. It's brought to you by Cooker, spelled Quooker. Check them out at cooker.co.uk. That's spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you want to get in touch with Tim, email dearlovejoy@gmail.com. And Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.